Three. Abadi Gadi, everyone. This is Professor Amon-Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, former city councilman for the city of Compton, former Compton College Board of Trustees, and former Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees, longtime student of Kawi, the philosophy created by Dr. Maulana Karenga. And we want to welcome you here to the Black Conscious Corner, and we hope that you've had a beautiful day. Today, we have a very special guest, but before we get started, I want to introduce Brother Ernest McBride, who's an archivist for the McBride a Senior Historical Contributions and Activism in Long Beach Community, where his father was recognized as an institution in that city, and he's as an archivist, as well as the McBride family as a whole, their institution in Long Beach, as far as making it a better place for the African-American families and community. We got Brother Mashinda out of Louisiana, who is an activist, work with youth and getting them to understand their role in the struggle and their role in their personal development, teaching them self-discipline and how to think for themselves. We have Brother Ahi out of Detroit, who is an activist, a longtime student of the movement, and keeping us abreast of what's going on in Detroit. And we have Brother Rasiki Maskani, who is the architect of this platform, the Community Education Network, which is on, which premieres every Wednesday with special guests and discussions, as well as other platforms of reggae and health seminars that he have on discussing. Today we have a very special guest, as I said. He's not only a special guest from the standpoint of his accomplishments as a graduate of California State University, PhD out of SC, and he's a longtime community activist, former city councilman twice for the city of Inglewood, and now he's on the Los Angeles Police Commission, a very important commission that decides a number of issues that come before them from the community. And we are blessed as a people to have this brother on that commission because of his wit and his intelligence, his scholarship, and the fact he's from the hood, straight out from the hood. Brother, family man, just all well-rounded professor over at Southwest Community College, where he worked with high school classes and transitioning from high school to college. Just a wonderful brother in many ways. And we have to always recognize achievement and brothers that come up from the hood and getting key positions, but at the same time, being able to get through this system, this wicked system of graduating from colleges and getting his PhD. And we're honored to have him as a guest. He's going to start us off by talking about what his accomplishments. And I know a lot of them because I worked with him when he first got elected in Inglewood with our Long Beach students, for one of the youngest city councilman when he was elected back in the 80s. And then at the same time, he started the Youth BAPAC, Black American Political Association, that was started by Willie Brown as a complement to the Black State, California State Black Caucus. So we're going to get started right away. Danny, you can just go ahead. If I missed anything with regards to your, that you want to be mentioned about, you go right ahead. And at the same time, tell us a little bit about the why young people should be voting and the value of the Black vote and why politics is essential. So we have a number of Black people that you have them that register do vote. But enough of us have not registered. Go ahead, Danny. Talk about it.
Let me just jump in, Brother Roth. Thank you very much for the introduction. I will add just one thing that sort of puts a date on all of what I may have been able to achieve so far and what I'm hoping to continue to add to as I count the days and enjoy the opportunities God gives me. A week ago, I had my third great grandchild born, a third great granddaughter. And
Right.
it
That's a
is
beautiful
it's an
thing.
exciting time to be able to see the generations. My mother-in-law is living with us, and to be able to see her great great granddaughter in the
All
same
right.
place, you know. So that's that it's a rare opportunity we have to have all the family able to be. And tonight, when we finish the call here, I'm going to jump on another Zoom with my family because my brother is have we're celebrating his heavenly birthday
Okay.
today. He would have been 70 today. So we're excited about being able to do that with his wife, my sister-in-law, my brothers, his sons, and our cousins gonna come together. And we try to do it every June 30th on his birthday. Just get on a Zoom and see everybody and celebrate the fact that we're here and they're here with us spiritually and in our lives. So again, thank you very much, you and Rashiki, for inviting me back to talk about something that I have difficulty saying I've not been a part of all of my life. My first political experience was when my mother was the night campaign manager of John F. Kennedy's headquarters here in Los Angeles. And as a 6-year-old, going to the campaign headquarters with my mother and seeing people practice their received right to participate in the electoral process, and seeing Black folks who were in their first careers out of college taking advantage of the opportunity to move this community in all types of ways. Tom Bradley was a police officer before a councilman, before becoming mayor. Mervyn Dimley was a school teacher and a friend of the family. And Diane Watson and I tease each other, call her my big sister. But she was at that time an educator, later a congresswoman, and then an ambassador. I can't say finally because her story is not yet finished. But all of those people, Yvonne Brathwaite Burke, who I worked for as an intern, former congresswoman, a lawyer, currently a lawyer, still practicing, the congresswoman, then supervisor, first African American supervisor here in Los Angeles. So I had a great opportunity to learn from folks who were breaking ground each and every day, and just to be able to participate in that process, to see the elected office as a tool for the community and not just a seat of power, but a tool that as my mother used to remind me every day, the question would be, okay, you came home, what'd you do for your constituents today? How did they benefit from you being in office? To recognize that that's still something that I have to think about and have to accomplish on a daily basis. What do I do that's in the best interest of the Black community that I serve and in the greater city of Los Angeles now and in the suburbs? The interesting part is I literally moved back to Los Angeles to hide out, to be a recovering politician, as it were, as I like to say. And it was taking my daughter to have tea on a Saturday morning in the neighborhood at Hot and Cold Cafe here in Leimert Park. I was hooded up, sweats, and tennis shoes, no socks, and I was going to just go to the place in the neighborhood and have a cup of tea. And she and I walked into a community meeting, and they were talking about the Leimert Park Business District, was talking about the future of Leimert Park. And you know, you take 15 steps into the tea house and into the restaurant. And I stopped. I said, "Oh no, I'm here with my youngest daughter. I'm here with Sinclair. This is going to be interesting." And I turn around, and she was assessing the room, looking to see who was in there talking about the future of Leimert Park. And so I ordered my tea, ordered her tea, handed her tea, and she went and took a seat on the front row, sitting underneath the moderator for the whole program they were having. And when they stopped and they were ready to take questions, she raised her hand. And I was sitting in the back in the corner trying to just be nondescript in any fashion, enjoying my tea. And she stood up and she said, "Well, you all have been talking about the future of Leimert Park. And as I look around this room, I'm the only one that's going to be alive in that future. So what kind of respect is that to show to the young people following you when you don't invite us to be a part of planning the future of our city, that our community that we're going to live in? And some folks had the audacity to turn around and look at me like I was supposed to answer the question. And I was like, excuse me, sounds like the young lady asked you all a very important question that you should be including in whatever plans you have. What's the answer to her question? And I sat back down and I realized then that I was going to be all right because my daughter, who had watched me campaign, helped me campaign, worked in other campaigns, had an idea about what she thought our community should be, was willing to take on the role of being actively involved in that future. And I think we may have talked about this before, but we have the opportunity, we who are still on A line, may not be the front line, but on A line, to bring young people into the process. They don't have to know the answers. They don't even have to know the questions. They have to see what the process is, because it's the process that they need to be able to master in order to determine what will happen in their future and with their families and with their children. So I'm again excited to be here and to be able to talk about politics, particularly from the black hand side, but broad politics in this new American and California environment where we find ourselves. It is it's an interesting place, and for me, it's a challenging place because there are challenges to my sense of integrity and responsibility based on not just the issues that are being raised, but who's raising them and how they're being raised. And some allegiances and alliances are going to be tested and have been tested already in other parts of the country. But here in Los Angeles, they're going to really be tested with the upcoming election should certain items get on the agenda, get on the ballot in November. So it's a good time. I'll stop there and we can pick it up wherever you'd like, Brother Roth.
Tell us a little bit about this movement in the Democratic Socialist that's in the East Coast, in New York, and some people say there's a chance for one in Denver and one in Michigan. And what does that mean? And how do we engage young people in politics? And then you can tell us a little bit about what are the challenges on the police commission.
Well, the first challenge is the same that we've had with both the Democrat and Republican parties, or the Green Party, or Libertarian, or whatever you may have been, is what is our agenda? What do we plan to do? What is important to us? What builds who we are and allows us to take full part of what is this place we call America? And how do we in this new dynamic differentiate an agenda between the Democratic Party that we're familiar with and the new Democratic Socialist Party that is growing, even here in Los Angeles? What does it mean to be a democratic socialist? I'm not sure we ever answered what does it mean to be a Democrat or what does it mean to be a Republican, but it's still a question that needs to be answered. I think that we need to, stop believing that we can't work together and sit and have the kind of conversations that we're having, hopefully tonight, on some of the issues that are real and decide what is our path. What do we want to do? Who do we want to support? Who do we want to invest in to represent us in electoral spaces, from water district to school board to city council to county supervisor to mayor to council member to governor to what state legislature? All of those questions are in play each and every day for us because we never have that conversation in the real. And unfortunately, we believe the hype sometime, and we buy the hype sometime, and it's who are people endorsed at as opposed to what do they stand for, what have they done, what do they believe in that I can believe in, and that's part of where we have to become much more mature in our political understanding of what it is that's going on, and be willing to recognize that. And I used to say this while I was in elective office. I say it even more now is. The office belongs to the people. I'm just the representative. I have an idea. I have a platform, but more importantly, I have a listening ear, and I want to hear from you. And what I learned over my 17 years in elective office was often black folks want to, they want you to preach to them. They don't want to talk to you. They want you to preach to them that we like complaining about something that we don't fully understand or fear something from, but we don't want to sit and do the process of planning that requires our thought and our commitment to being engaged. Because when you're part of the political process, you're actively involved. You're not sitting on the sidelines. You're not sitting in the lounger, listening to the news. You're out there making it happen by talking to your neighbor, by talking to your pastor, by engaging and organizing your community in many way, different ways. And that's we've got to do that if we expect to have an appropriate play, equity play, in what is being decided on in our communities. And we're not doing that. Then we you get what you vote for or what you don't vote for.
When you think about the movement with young people who are coming out of high school, and you got this mail-in ballots that the Supreme Court Trump had written an executive order to stop it, but the Supreme Court upheld the right for states to run their election. But tell us a little bit about Inglewood. It's a growing city. You were part of the city council. You got stadiums everywhere. You got a racetrack, a Hollywood Park. It's not a racetrack no more, it's a casino. What is the black population of Inglewood? And good people be thinking it's a black city. But tell us about Inglewood.
I think the Inglewood now is a much different city than when I was on the council. I moved to Inglewood in 1967 and went through elementary, junior high, and high school there, and then come to Long Beach State for college, and then come back to the city and ran for city council because I lived in it and worked and played in it. Now. You've got a major, and there were a big five in Inglewood when I was there. The two hospitals, Daniel Freeman and Sentinella, were the largest employers. The airport was another significant player in the future and the history of Inglewood. And now you've got a little different spin. You've got a broad entertainment complex with Intuit Dome for the Clippers and SoFi Stadium for the Rams and Chargers, and the Forum still there. I sold Cokes in the Forum as a high school kid, and later got season tickets when I got elected to the city council, and enjoyed those riches of the experience. But at the same time, there were opportunities for black businesses in the city of Inglewood, and those opportunities for residents who had small cottage industry businesses operated out of their home, or those who had a storefront someplace in the city had an understood that they could participate in the economic growth of the city of Inglewood. What I'm hearing now is that environment has changed, hopefully, that it is a contract between the council and the businesses that are in, and everybody else is scrapping for whatever scraps there may be out the side. Now, that is not to criticize. That is to say that in Inglewood, the folks voted into the folks who are on the council and the mayor's office, and they've got to learn to work with those folks because they are their representatives, or they've got to change their representatives. Either come with a plan that meets your needs, or expect the people who have a plan to get their needs met. And that's real in Inglewood as it is in Los Angeles and other cities around the country. Clearly in Detroit and in Atlanta and New York, we're seeing power being shifted from what we thought were secure positions, to new people, to new hands. And we've got to figure out, as black folks, what does that mean for us? What do we need to do to ensure that we still have not just a seat at the table, but an opportunity to bring others to the table to ensure that our interests are being talked about and being addressed in real fashions. And I'm not preaching to the choir in this sense, but I know you all know that we've been the backbone of organized labor, and now at least in California, the numbers have changed. Just like the numbers of Inglewood was once, as you said, a thriving black community. It was once the had the highest per capita college educated in black folks in any city in the country, and that showed in the way in which their children were educated in great schools, and unfortunately, the people got compliant and complacent and passed on the role of making decisions to others who weren't as vested in their future as they thought. And now they see their schools closing. My alma mater is no more. Morningside High School no longer exists. It will be consumed by developments that extend the Intuit Dome in some ways and change the reflection of the community in other ways. But it's the reality that, and just as I say that, I'm reminded I got a text earlier today from the Alumni Association. So we still are engaged in conversations about what goes on in Inglewood and what we can do to help former monarchs in that process. But my point really is that to say that in Inglewood, the opportunities are still there. And the question is, how do we organize? How does that community, how do people who want to take full advantage of those opportunities align themselves to leverage the power the numbers have, the voters have, to make sure that the elected officials are hearing and responding to what they want and not just getting caught up in the squabble between the big powers in the city at this point?
What's the population of black people in Inglewood? You remember?
Well, it's less than 50% of the total population now. It is the Latino population is a greater number, numeric number. I don't know if it's a greater voting population at this point, but it's a greater numeric number in terms of residents of the city.
Well, what about the growth of the city? I mean, you got the Inglewood Cemetery, which everybody uses practically. You
We
have
are definitely in Inglewood Park Cemetery.
and then you have the Forum, like you said. You have SoFi, and you have the Clippers Stadium, and you have Hollywood Casino. I mean, does that
And you've
add to
got movie
the
theaters, and
value of?
you've got a lot. Well, the truth is, a lot is going on. The one of the things that we experienced my last year on the city council and mayor in 2011. And what we really learned in 2006, 2007 was that on a per capita square footage basis, on a square footage basis, restaurants in Inglewood make more money than restaurants in other part of the county of Los Angeles. And so the black businesses that have been there, the restaurants, the Serving Spoon, well, couple of other places, the Chili's and the Red Lobster, lead their specific companies in terms of total retail expense, and those customers are black. Now in Inglewood, something that troubles me greatly, but is a fact of reality, is that there's a restaurant called Fiesta Martin, family-owned Mexican restaurant. They now have five locations in the city of Inglewood, but no black employees. But when you walk in the door, you look like you're at, a black family spot because it's most of the customers, 80% of the customers are black folks, not just living in Inglewood, but from around the area. And I think part of it is it's pretty good Mexican food, but more importantly, they've got an open bar. They've got a liquor license at each of their locations. And, we like to consume. And when we consume, we like to drink. And when we drink, we spend money. And when we spend money, other people get rich. So the question is, how do we turn that around? There's some small black businesses, growing black businesses in Inglewood that are trying to compete in that space, and we just have to find ways to support them and engage and support them. I mentioned the Serving Spoon a second ago. They were recognized with a James Beard Award, and a culinary award given to top restaurants and restaurants that serve a community need but provide quality food and a quality experience. And I think, and I might be wrong in this, but I know they're the first Inglewood restaurant to ever earn a Beard Award. And this is an international award. Canadian, US, and Mexican restaurants are judged and raised, and they were honored with a Beard Award. And they started by the current ownership's father, the wife of the team. Her father started the restaurant. He was a part-time actor, and on a program. Some of you might remember the TV show Dallas and its spinoff, Knots Landing, and they needed a scene in a restaurant, and he had just opened up his restaurant, and he said, "Hey, you can come and film in my place." And it became a staple, not just on the TV show, but in the community, because it brought all of these industry folks to a location in Inglewood. This is early 80s into the 90s, and it is now packed. Typically on a weekend and some weekdays, you've got to wait in line to get a seat to enjoy good food. And I spent many a time both sitting at the counter and sitting in the booth, having both meetings, but enjoying the good conversation and the good food. We have places like that, and we need to support those places to make sure that they're able to compete in an environment that we currently live in, where folks like to order food, with what's called Postmate and other places to bring the food to you rather than go out to it. But we got to get out and support those restaurants that need to see us in those seats and to see us bringing our children in so that they get the experience of eating in a restaurant, not just eating at home, and expanding those opportunities. So, Inglewood, I think, is still a place. It's become much more expensive, and some people will argue that it's the entertainment places, SoFi Stadium, and the Intuit Dome, and the remodeling of the Forum that made housing expensive. I disagree, because the last I checked, no, the people who buy the tickets, particularly the season ticket holders that watch the Rams and the Chargers or the Clippers, come from outside the city, so that their income is not being spent and invested in Inglewood. But who's investing in Inglewood? The residents are watching those games. Some of them have tickets, yeah, they got season tickets, but a lot of those residents are watching t those games on TV, like I do. And I think the real truth is that in Los Angeles, all of a sudden it got too expensive to live on the West Side. The property sizes in Inglewood, you can get a 3,700 square foot lot, 4,000 up to 9,000 square foot lot, and a house that was then selling in 2011 for $300,000, $400,000, and they come across the freeway and with full cash, with family incomes of $400,000 a year, working in Techno Beach, right here with it at Snapchat or Google or any of the companies that are, excuse me, right across the street in Silicon Beach down in Playa Vista. And they were like, "Oh, wait a minute, we can live here right off the freeway. I don't have to get on the freeway to go to work. I don't have to pay $1.5 million for a little townhouse in downtown LA." And they started buying homes for cash, and the property values shot up. The property costs shot up, not the values, but the costs shot up. And that, pardon me, and that changed the tenor. So what was once a predominantly black community quickly gentrified in the course of 3 or 4 years. And you saw people walking in and folks, black folks saying, "Hey, well, I want to move on back to Mississippi. I'll move on back to Atlanta. I can sell my house. I may own $100,000 less, but I'm about to collect $600,000 for it right now. Yeah, we're gonna make that deal and we're gonna move out," not thinking about what it would mean for their children's ability to buy a home in a city that they grew up in.
Well,
Just
answer
don't
me
have
this.
that consciousness.
Now, down Century, there's a lot of hotels. Is that part of Inglewood when you get to the Hilton, the Marriott, and the Sheraton, and all of that?
That's all the city of Los Angeles.
Where's Inglewood boundary? Do you remember?
So on the east side,
I
just
mean, because the
roughly.
airport is out there and all of that.
No, so the east side is Van Ness for the most part, north and south. The north side of the city is, say, Hyde Park Avenue. It does not, the city of Inglewood does not go as far north as Slauson, for example, but cuts from Van Ness over to Hyde Park and then up into Lower Ladera. So it cuts across La Cienega, but still south of Slauson. And then the west side of the city is Ladera Heights, the 405 freeway, and a little couple streets that bounce just west of the 405 freeway. The airport is not in the city of Inglewood. It is in the city of Los Angeles, but it's adjacent.
Right. Okay.
In the
Now,
south is Lenox, though actually 120th Street would be the southern boundary of the city.
I'm gonna let some people ask questions. My last question is: how did the police commission work? How did you get on it? And how do you see you being a being able to assist and do some positive things in the police commission? Because most people, we don't like police, and we challenge it. And you got Black Lives Matter down there calling
And
everybody.
they come to the meeting and question my blackness on a regular basis. And
All right, go
it's
ahead.
okay because
Tell
we
us
know.
about that. Because you
So,
got a number of cases up there.
yeah, and I'll be quick. As I like to tell people, I didn't sign up to be on the police commission. I said earlier that I'm recovering, as I've said many times, I'm a recovering politician. I like to think myself as a recovering statesman because that's what I tried to be more of when I was in elective office. And I decided, because I'm president of an organization called Move LA, and we have sponsored four ballot initiatives here in the county of Los Angeles and the city of Los Angeles, and each of those four have succeeded. At least 70% of the folks voting for our initiatives around public transit, affordable housing, and environmental air quality, for the most part, environmental concerns. To tax ourselves, a quarter-cent sales tax, into perpetuity, to make sure that we can build out our public transit system, or that we have the ability to house all of Los Angeles, called ULA, where there's a 4% tax on the transfer tax that's paid when you sell a house for less than between $5 million and $10 million, or a 5% tax on the transfer tax for a home or a property that's sold for more than $10 million. All of those monies go into a fund that provides financial assistance for renters who are being illegally removed from their property, provides financing for the development and building of affordable housing. Affordable mean workforce housing or senior housing or transitional housing for the homeless. That also provides educational resources to help people complete their education or pay off their educational loans. All of these pieces add to the quality of life for individuals. Anyway, so I as president of Move LA, I said, okay, I'd be willing to serve on a city commission, thinking that because I work in the renewable energy space, that I would get on the Water and Power Commission. I knew that there were going to be a couple, three, actually three vacancies. The chair and two other people were stepping down. They'd served for a long time. And I put my name on a list to do that. And I got a call from the mayor's office saying the mayor would like to appoint you to the police commission. And before I could stop myself, I said, I didn't sign up for that. And he laughed, and David laughed, and he said, no, the mayor really wants to think she believes she needs you on a police commission. And 2 weeks later, I was hosting a fundraiser for Mayor Bass, and she walked in. She didn't say hello, Danny. She walked in and said, I need you on the police commission. And when the mayor walks up to you and says, I need you on the police commission, you say, yes, ma'am, I'll serve on the police commission. And it's funny because I didn't realize at that point, and it took me a couple of weeks to go through the process, almost a month and a half to really to go through the whole process, but I started remembering that, wait a minute. Somebody you might know, might remember, Brother Ra, Kyle Jackson, my fraternity brother, retired as a commander at LAPD. And Kenny Gardner, another Long Beach State student, passed while working for LAPD, but was a recognized leader in community policing for the Los Angeles Police Department. And then, as I started to think about it, when I moved to Inglewood, my neighbor was a captain in the Inglewood Police Department, and my neighbor next door was the sergeant in Inglewood Police Department. So I had some experiences talking and working with people in law enforcement, and then thought even more about it. I knew I had friends who were counsel that represented the police, and as you say, Ra, who demonstrated, as I did, against some of the actions in Los Angeles and in Inglewood for police activity. And I was like, well, wait, no, I can turn those experiences into a positive understanding. And then I remembered that, and I said this during my confirmation hearing, that you're getting not just a former elected official, but you're getting a former gang interventionist who ran a gang intervention program when there were no other gang intervention programs. So I'm bringing the attitude of the people that I serve to the role of commissioner on the Los Angeles Police Department, and taking my time, not trying to rush to change the world. And I'm not down with the people to say defund the police, Because at the end of the day, if somebody breaks into my house or somebody tries to steal my car, I want their cell numbers because I'm gonna call them to come. All those defund the police folks, I expect you to respond and protect me because that's you got rid of the folks we pay to do that. Rather than let's, as a commissioner, I now have the ability, we oversee the police department, we supervise and evaluate the police chief, and we handle all of the public policy issues, including the punishment for any violations of the law that the officers make. So we have the ability to create an environment where the police, as I said today in our meeting, we meet every Tuesday, that it's not about being competent, it's about being proficient, and that our officers need to be proficient culturally. They need to be sensitive to the communities they serve. They come from this, many of them come from these communities, and they need to see themselves as servants of the people and not enforcers of the law, but servants of the law, under the law. And act, and as we do that, then we're better able to see a department that responds. Let me sort of pivot here and add a little trinket to this. What I did not know, but I do now know, and I talk about regularly, is that you can be an 18-year-old high school graduate with a GED, not necessarily a high school diploma, and you can apply and join the Los Angeles Police Department. And in your first year on the job, you are guaranteed to take home $120,000 salary, benefits, and it's a lifetime pension. Right? It's not a, it doesn't end when you retire or you get injured on the job. It's lifetime. And I'm not sure there are other places in this state and in this country that you can make that money with a high school education and not have people looking over your shoulder wondering what you're doing. So I see law enforcement, public safety, as I prefer to say, as a career that we need to better understand and better move our young people into, because it is really a career. And you can be an art major and work in the police department, because you need sketch artists, you need graphic artists to do it. You definitely can be a computer nerd and now work in law enforcement, and you can expand. And you don't have to just work in LAPD. You can work, it's a broad career in that range, and it can be a service industry. I talked to my friends who have retired from the Highway Patrol and retired from other departments, and they talk about the ability that they had to buy a house and put their th kids through college and enjoy a good life. But they also talk about the service that they did to the community when they were in law, when they wore the uniform, and how they tried to represent and be accountable to the people they served. And that's something we've got to recognize, is that this is an opportunity, just like being a doctor, lawyer, or a fireman. Well, it's actually as good as being a fireman, which might even, which has the same type of economic skills. But it creates an opportunity, it builds community, it builds family, it builds the opportunity for us to turn around and serve ourselves and not have to wait to be served by others.
Okay, Brother Ernest, do you have any questions and comments?
The only thing that said, what you said about the police, I found out in my, because I respect the police. And my dad here in Long Beach was responsible for getting the first black police officer hired on the police department. It took him, protesting and going to the city from 1943 to 48, and he finally got him on there. And so I've always, ever even now, every time I see like a Long Beach police officer, especially a minority officer, I feel a sense of pride, because he got the first black on, and then the first Hispanic who used to live across the alley from us when I was growing up. And so I got a different perspective than most people, because I respect the police. And throughout my life, encounters that I've had with them, they've been good officers, because there's a lot more good officers and then there are bad ones.
I
If I
agree,
can put it
and I
like
agree
that,
with
I can
you.
confidently say that, like in Long Beach. But and then I've noticed a lot of my friends that kind of look down on the police. Well, when they kind of tell their story, I say, well, man, you didn't respect the officer. So why would you, he pull you up, and he says, "Good evening, sir. May I see your license?" "Well, why are you stopping me?" And then they go in this attitude thing. I said, "And you shouldn't," because I try to teach my kids. I said, "When you coming up, you dealing with a person that has a firearm on, and he's got authority.
A lethal weapon.
Your lethal weapon, and he, you don't know how his day has been going, or what kind of people he
And
is
that's, they are
usually
human.
running into bad people. So that's gonna give him a bad attitude." I say, "So don't be sharp with them, because most of my buddies that got in trouble with the police was running their mouth. If they had kept their mouth shut." And because the officer was respecting you, so why are you gonna disrespect him? So I can never even get over that with buddies of mine. But I see the officers now, and I feel a sense of pride when I see black officers, and then I usually go up and talk to them and tell them about that. And a lot of them give me their cards and stuff, and it's an honorable profession.
And
And
that's
so
the
that was on
key.
the thing when Dr. Ross said, "Well, most people don't like." Well, my family, I taught them, "Hey, don't take that attitude. You need to, because if you give respect, somebody give you respect, you should give it back. And we wouldn't have a lot of the problems that we have." Now, that's only from my perspective growing up, because I even got in trouble and did some time, but I was supposed to because I was wrong. So I'm not gonna be down on the officer because he arrested me, because that I needed to be arrested. So
Well, Brother
that's,
McBride, I appreciate that because the reality is they're human.
yeah.
They're trying to make a way. They want to go
That's
home. They're
like
in
us,
Greyhound. They
yeah.
want to go home. But the just to put this in context, at Cal State University Long Beach, one of the very early experiences I have, even after recognizing my brother Ra here, is going to demonstrate in Signal Hill at the killing of Brother Ron Settles.
Yeah.
All right. And that experience, it is, I can talk about some of it now because it's many years past, but we were demonstrating outside the department, and no, Johnny Cochran hadn't gotten there yet, and no one knew the status of Ron. Excuse me, not Iran, but of the other brother that was in the room with him, who was in lockup,
Right, yeah.
and Roland Peterson. And I had the, as I remember, I told you I grew up with neighbors that were in Englewood Police Department, and they were still in Englewood Police Department when I got to Long Beach State. So I made a phone call to my house and had my mother run a little note next door to the sergeant. And had the chief of Englewood call the chief
Signal
in
Hill.
Signal Hill and say that a young man, student at Long Beach State, gave my name, wanted to do a welfare check of the young man who was incarcerated. And after a little while, officer came out, asked who I was, and I raised my hand. He said, "Come with me." Folks thought I was getting in trouble, but no, I was going to check. I was using a relationship to check on the brother who was incarcerated. When you know how the system works, you can work the system to your benefit, to the collective benefit. Yes, we were out on the street demonstrating because what happened was wrong, but at the same time, there was that micro opportunity to make sure that another brother didn't get fouled up and that he got to go home that night. We have those opportunities. Law enforcement is just one of many places where we need to understand how the system works. Getting back, Brother Rod, to the conversation that we t started talking about, the political process. We spend a whole lot of time at the barbershop and the beauty parlors and in pool halls, wherever we might hang out, the park, whatever it is, talking about the system and how it's corrupt and how it's done wrong. But the reality is, until we are engaged in it, we can't have a say in it. We got to be there. We got to be participate in it. And it's more than just voting. The real power at the local level is in your block club and in your church congregation, if your church is in the city in which you live. And we had to work those networks and bring the elected officials to see us and hear from us and tell them what we want. And we've got to do that in a collective way. Yeah, the business people have a different conversation with electeds than the residents do, but that's okay because some of us are business people and they need to be speaking our truth too, and we need to speak theirs. But it's a collective. We have to work the process in the political, whether you like what the Democratic Socialists are saying, or you like what the Democratic Party is saying, and even for those of you who may be Republican, you got to have an agenda that represents your interests and hopefully our collective interests, and you got to carry that agenda forward. And it has to be the attitude that either I get some from my people or nobody gets any. It can't be you wait your turn, because that's not how the process works. You got to stand for what you want and articulate it and organize for it, and not just demand it, but demonstrate it. And demonstrate it by being part of the process and bringing others with you to be part of the process.
All
Bring
right.
our troops so we can have a ground attack.
Brother He, you have any comment from Detroit? Are you still there? Go ahead.
Yes, I do. I have just two questions for the brother, Dr. Tabor. As far as the Democratic Party first, number one, is concerned, the so-called hijacking of this party that seems to embrace the conservatives even more so than the liberal people who will vote with Trump on any policy that generally is really not a Democratic pro policy. And you know, that's doing a whole lot. Now that they got a history more recently of the way they're dealing with the liberals, like for instance, Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders had his pulse on something right before they hijacked him, kicked him to the side, and put Biden in that position. And Bernie was making money and was making as much money as the rest of these folks from donations. That should have told these idiots something. Because when they pushed him aside, a lot of these young first-time voters and people who got, don't forget that. And the Democratic's policy since then and a little bit before then has not been in the favor of the brown girls. And we got Rashida here, my people. And I think this new group, these young people, are a little bit more sympathetic to what our plight is and to what the common man's plight is. And like the pivot of the Republican Party to an extreme right, I'm not going to say that it's an extreme left for the Democrat, but it is left of where they are now. I want your opinion on that. And I like your opinion. I'm going to play the devil's advocate as far as the police are concerned in LA area, city and county, and the homicide rate between the civilians and the cops, which is extremely high. And anybody looking at it on the outside would kind of say that, you know, this is a portion of genocide. This is a genocide against non-white people. And so I understand being an ally of the police officers and, you know, wanting, those are good careers. But what about as far as the people are concerned and that conflict with, you know, it being okay to be killing non-black people in LA? Those are my two questions.
Let me jump on the first one real quick and thank you for both questions. So a little reset. I worked in the Clinton administration under Ron Brown in the Commerce Department. And what I learned quickly was the appreciation that the Clinton administration and his entire administration had for the Secretary of Commerce, Ronald H. Brown, who was the architect for his campaign and his electoral victory. I also learned that the minute he passed in that plane crash, that the dogs were let loose, the white folks who had aspired to be the Commerce Secretary and who didn't understand how you could give such a powerful position to a black man at that time, turned on everybody and anybody who they could to move the agenda in a different way. I think that the revolt, the usurping that you described really was a few minutes before what you described, when the people decided, the Democratic leadership, particularly the women in leadership in the party, that Hillary Clinton needed to be the candidate and not allowed a full democratic process of the party members, the active party members, to identify who they wanted to see succeed Barack Obama. And in that initiative, that softened the ranks tremendously, because not just young people who had come to the party who'd contribute their $5 or their $10 to Barack's campaign, but even the middle income members of the party who wanted to see a continuation of a broader democratic spectrum that represented the issues that the communities around the country, the indigenous folks, the black folks, the brown folks, the Native Americans, the conscious Asian American community wanted to have us moving forward on, they knew that was going by the wayside, because it was back to the old guard, you know, another Clinton and another white woman who felt entitled to be the rep rather than earning the mantle of the leadership of the party. So I think that created a schism that allows now for the Democratic Socialists to come in, because that intelligentsia of young people, combined with those folks who are, I call them the generation of everybody gets a trophy. You know, you don't have to earn a trophy when you play a sport. You know, used to be you had to star, you had to really be significant to the team to get a trophy at the end of the season. But we went through years where everybody on the bench got a trophy. And so they think they're entitled because they got educated at Brown or Harvard or Stanford, just simply because they got a good education and they can talk a talk and they can attempt to relate to what our experiences are, those who are still coming up, and they miss the boat entirely. But that's the voice. That's the voice out there, because the mainstream Democrats have turned everybody else off. Folks who are looking for a place to belong, they've opened that door for these folks. And it's going to be a very difficult door to close, or a very difficult process to consolidate, if the party wants to exist and regain even the opportunities that this grifter in the White House is currently presenting. But all that in one piece. Let me go back to just LA Police Department. What I learned changed what I believed. So that's probably the best way for me to introduce this piece. I came to the commission thinking that you said that there has been a continuous assault from LAPD on black folk here in the city. And what I learned from the data is that black folk in the city have been killing each other three times the rate, sometimes four times the rate, of even officer-involved shootings, not just murders, but officer-involved shootings here in the city of Los Angeles. And recently, last year, for example, was a high in the period. The years, the 6 or 7 years preceding 2025, had been a cooling of relationships, had been a reduction in officer-involved shootings and violence. Yes, there were, you know, gang-involved activities, and yes, there were the threat of people stopping, pretextual stops, giving some disrespect to the process and taking advantage of the process by the police officers. I'm not saying that didn't exist, but the numbers don't show, of the 53 officer-involved shootings last year, the majority of people who were being shot and the majority of people doing the shooting weren't black or white. So I just wanted to let that sit for you a second. There are more Asian police officers in the Los Angeles Police Department than there are black police officers right now. And I want to put that in context, that what that says is that we have, because of our concern and our contempt for law enforcement, we have abandoned that post and we've allowed others to come in. And now the conversations like we were having today in the commission about what's the cultural competency of the individuals and cultural proficiency of the individuals who wear the uniform, and how do we expect them to represent the various communities? One of the interesting and isolating events of our past year has been this 47's demand on immigration, and has let loose his militaristic force called ICE into our communities. And while the large number of in the Latino community have really been affected, so have the Haitians, the Jamaicans, the Trinidadians, the Belizeans, the folks who've come here trying to make a way for their families and grow their families, who still have a relationship at home and who've not yet completed citizenship. They too have been arrested by ICE and shipped back to other who knows where, because ICE is not informing us. So we have not just the issue of what law enforcement does, but who it does for. And whenever we've talked about that, since I've been on the commission, whenever we've talked about ICE and its impact in our community, and it's had a significant play in Los Angeles, because 47 likes to say he wants to take over the leadership. That's why he ran that crazy man for mayor, that, and is running another nut. I'm not going to call it Hilton a nut, but another guy that, you know, sucking on his tit, trying to be governor of the state of California, that we have to understand that, we're in it for ourselves, and we have to communicate across our culture and see Africans and African Americans finally realizing that we need to be working together with one another and building that plan, going back to the notion that we got to have a plan that speaks to our interests and our needs in order to see success going forward. So I think as you've identified, that the real key is making sure that wherever the police department is, that there's a system hold it accountable, which commissions can do. There's rules and regulations, that policies that need to be addressed and identified and impacted to make sure that the playing field is level. And then there's the vigilance of Black Lives Matters and others who come and beg the question, what are you doing? And why are you not? Why are we seeing so little of the benefits of having public safety in our community? And we have to answer that question. And that's what I'm trying to do, and make sure that when I speak up, that it's in the interest of the community and in the interest of what not just is fair, but what is equitable. Because we've given a whole lot of work towards fair and not gotten enough. We need to see equity in the context of those who have less get more. And we certainly have less at this point.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Brother Roger Key.
I want to thank you, Dr. Tabor, for enlightening us on this information. I think it makes a lot of sense about what you're saying, and I'm thankful that we do have people like you that's addressing these issues and areas that we definitely need to be a part of. A lot of people, like you say, sit back and say things about the police or don't participate, but has the biggest complaints. So I'm thankful for people like you. And I want to reiterate what Ernest was talking about and you were talking about when it comes to engaging police. Neely Fuller has excellent information codes when dealing with police. He has the three Fs: don't fuss, don't fight, don't flee. And I've been fairly successful with police engagement throughout my life because of how the approach is, like Ernest was mentioning. You know, when the police, if you engaging with the police, I can't say that they're always polite, but if you're polite, I think that's very important that you have a code, and the codes, when you use them, normally works. And that's what you want to do. You want to be able to walk away from the situation. So don't give them no fuel to, you know, engage you improperly. So that's what I've always done. I always say, how you doing, officer? May I help you? And that usually diffuses any tension that may that they may have, because they at least feel that they're being respected. So it's really important. I always tell people, when I watch the Sandra Bland episodes on TV, on, you know, on YouTube or whatever, the police officer didn't flare up until she did. And that's very important. I think she could have walked away from that situation. That's my personal opinion. And a lot of people are highly upset about that situation. No, I don't like that situation, but I think she could have handled it a different way. And people may not be cool with what I'm saying, but that's the way I see it. Yeah. So I really thank you.
I think you have said, and Brother McBride have said, that all we can ask for is respect, and we can ask for it by giving respect, and it's not going to always come back. You know, officers are human beings. It's a tough job throughout the day because they're dealing with all kind of people, and they don't know what's around the next corner. And I get that clearly now as a member of the commission. But at the same time, if we stop waiting for the first opportunity for us to engage law enforcement being a 911 call, and we started inviting the officers who work in our community to our churches, to our community activities, and we got to know them as people, and particularly the brothers and sisters working on the job, because we've got some brilliant African-American folks and people of African descent working in the Los Angeles Police Department, who are leading in a variety of different areas. The chief of detectives is a young African-American from Inglewood. All right. So we've got the opportunity to see them as people that we can work with. And I interrupt because I need to apologize. I'm getting blown up by my family on this other family Zoom. I think I shared today is my brother's 70th heavenly birthday, and we're going to do a Zoom in his name. He passed a couple of years back. If you will excuse me, let me slide out of here, but I'm welcome to come back anytime, Brother Rod.
Well, Dan, first of all, we're going to let you go, but I'm just going to tell you, I appreciate you being on the police commission to let us know what's really going on, because I grew up different. I mean, Watts, and we boxed with the police.
Yeah, I know see, who said that.
Let me say this right quick before you go. The reason police have changed is because of struggle, exposure, lawsuits, cameras, and community organizations, rebellions. The Watts Rebellion was over police brutality. Mm-hmm. Detroit Rebellion was over police brutality. Yes. And you have what was that downtown Los Angeles police who had the dope thing and the brother was still in the
FR
dope
division?
Yep. You had some police that when you go in closed session with the commission, y'all dealing with lawsuits, you're dealing with personnel issues, mm-hmm. you're dealing with police that made racist statements or beat up the girl on TV. Overreacted. There's a lot of things. The biggest lawsuits in most cities is with the police. You understand? And not only that, accidents where they tear up cars and stuff, speeding unnecessarily and things. I know there's some good police. Don't get me wrong. I love the police. I need them. I guess I'm in Compton. I need police. I love helicopters. I love all that. You understand? I feel safe. But I know there are some bad police, corrupt police that participate. We had crack houses and police was running. You understand? So we'll get you back to talk about some of that. Because yes. I know what y'all doing in closed session. You're settling disputes, dealing with what about that immunity police had from what they, I forget what they call it.
We got the mental health unit we're dealing with. It's human life and it's dealing with human life in a dramatic way.
You got the Kazee case lawsuit. You got this. It's so much. We're gonna let you go because I know you got to deal with your family. And that's important. And so, brother, we want to thank you for coming. But next time, we got to talk.
And I'll bring some folks with you who love to talk. We'll do that.
Yeah. All right, my brother.
All right, brothers. Be well.
All right. Yeah. We appreciate. I'm telling you, man. And Ernest, you remember Don Jackson
walking? Yeah. My dad and they was
when they pushed his head in the window, all these police pushed his head in the
window. NAACP planned that,
you know, the police was rough. Signal Hill police couldn't even go in Signal Hill. And not, we ain't
Signal Hill was really bad.
We wouldn't even drive through there. With regards to tickets and stuff like that, they used to get us. Our car was too low. You understand? Your windows were tinted. Oh, come on, man.
Yeah,
that's some good police. Don't get me wrong.
I'm like Rashid.
I do the three F's too. You understand? But at the same time, some of them police. They got three F's, and it ain't flee, flight, flow. It's beat your ass, F you up. You understand? Or they go to, what about the gangs in the police?
Oh, yeah.
You understand? Yeah, I mean, they sit around doing a shop and talking about who they beat butt up.
They be worn with the gangs, yeah.
He got away. You understand? I was letting y'all go ahead, but. I was going to jam, about, hey, man, I know what they do in closed session because I was in the city council. And I know that there's some police department, they so bad, nobody will insure them. They don't even have insurance because they get so many lawsuits and they mess up so much. But anyway, we'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? What about tomorrow?
Tomorrow, we have Mr. Edward Williams. A gentleman that spent lots of time with Francis Cress Welsing and Neely Fuller Jr. He's coming on for the second time, and the topic is racism and counter-racism.
Okay.
So that's what we got for tomorrow.
We're in the political struggle, and you got... general election coming up in November, and we got to mobilize Black people to vote and allies to vote for our interests. We're not voting for specific people. We're voting on our interests. You know, who best represent us? Now, some of these people, I'm against the sister that's running against Ms. Bass because she was first endorsed her. And I want to know, she says she's a part of the Democratic Socialist, but at the same time, I want to know who's behind her, who's giving her the money to go after Bass like she's doing. Because first she endorsed her, and then all of a sudden she run against her. And I know that the Aaron Hand is somewhere involved in that. You understand? Bass was a congresswoman. She was a state senator. She got more votes. She set the record in the most votes ever before in a city election when she got elected. They tried to blame her for a fire. She was out of the country. I mean, they demonized her and character assassinating her and things of this nature. But she built coalitions and alliances. She shut down liquor stores in her community. She did a lot of good things. We need to think about that. All right, then tomorrow, what's his name again, Roger Key?
Mr. Edward Williams.
Edward Williams. All right, then. And Ahi, take care of Detroit, brother.
Yes, sir, Professor. I certainly will. I'll see you guys tomorrow.
And thanks a lot for them fagos you sent me. I put some, I had to beat up my grandkids. They tried to get them. I said, no. You can't.
I bought two cases. I got the other case here. I said, I don't want to overwhelm you. So the other one will be coming in the fall.
All right, bro.
That's a whole lot of sugar for you. I don't want you to be too sugared up.
I need it though. I swear they the best soldiers in the world from that Michigan water, that Michigan River. Oh
yeah,
man.
That's about one of the few things we got going right now, that water.
Okay. Yes, sir. Michigan. All right. Y'all take care, brother. We'll see each other.
All right.
Y'all wish all
right. Peace one, Black Conscious Corner. Everybody continue to have a great day.
All right, then. 2000.